Well, happy Sabbath. Good morning. And it is another beautiful Sabbath day this spring. And I know we have several people traveling, and that's fine. Just want them to be safe. This morning, I want to talk to you about the night after the crucifixion. So that would be tonight, and I did a quick calculation around, if the numbers were right, and I know they're not right, so it would be around 1980 years ago, just approximately 84. But I want to talk to you about the events that surrounded the resurrection of Jesus, and it just seems almost so fantastical that some people have a hard time believing those events. And I want to give you some reasons today why you can believe it. And I want to share, the easiest way for me to do this is just to read it. It's from early writings, and that's what's being studied on Wednesday night prayer meeting. But this is a little ahead of where you're at. But it's from page 181 in the book Early Writings, it's from the 19th century Bible scholar E.G. White. The disciples rested on the Sabbath, sorrowing for the death of their Lord, while Jesus, the King of Glory, lay in the tomb. As night drew on, soldiers were stationed to guard the Savior's resting place, while angels unseen hovered above the sacred spot. The night wore slowly away, and while it was yet dark, the watching angels knew that the time for the release of God's dear Son, their loved commander, had nearly come. As they were waiting with the deepest emotion the hour of his triumph, a mighty angel came flying swiftly from heaven. His face was like lightning and his garments white as snow. Almost makes your skin crawl to think about that. His light dispersed the darkness from his track and caused the evil angels who had triumphantly claimed the body of Jesus to flee in terror from his brightness and glory. One of the angelic host who had witnessed the scene of Christ's humiliation, that's the crucifixion, was watching his resting place, joined the angel from heaven, and together they came to the grave. The earth trembled and shook as they approached, and there was a great earthquake. Terror seized the Roman guards. Where was now their power to keep the body of Jesus? They did not think of their duty or of the disciples stealing him away. As the light of the angels shone around them brighter than the sun, the Roman guard fell as dead men to the ground. One of the angels laid hold of the great stone and rolled from the door of the grave and seated himself upon it. The other entered the tomb and unbound the napkin from the head of Jesus. Then the angel from heaven, with a voice that caused the earth to quake, cried out, "Thou Son of God, thy Father calls thee, come forth." Death could not hold dominion over him any longer. Jesus arose from the dead, a triumph conqueror. In solemn awe, the angelic host gazed upon the scene, and Jesus came forth from the grave. Those shining angels prostrated themselves to the earth in worship and hailed him with songs of victory and triumph. Satan's angels had been compelled to flee before the bright, penetrating light of the heavenly angels, and they bitterly complained to their king that their prey had been violently taken from them, and that he whom they so much hated had risen from the dead. Satan and his host had exulted that their power over fallen man had caused the Lord of life to be laid in the grave. But short was their hellish triumph, for as Jesus walked forth from his prison house, a majestic conqueror, Satan knew that after a season he must die, and his kingdom pass unto him whose right it was. He lamented and raged that, notwithstanding all his efforts, Jesus had not been overcome, but had opened a way of salvation for man, and whosoever might walk in it and be saved. The evil angels and their commanders met in council to consider how they could still work against the government of God. Satan bade his servants go to the chief priests and elders. Said he, "We succeeded in deceiving them, blinding their eyes and hardening their hearts against Jesus. We made them believe that he was an impostor. That Roman guard will carry the hateful news that Christ has risen. We led the priests and elders on to hate Jesus and to murder him. Now hold it before them that if it becomes known that Jesus is risen, they will be stoned by the people for putting to death an innocent man." Satan knew that Jesus was innocent. As the host of heavenly angels departed from the grave and the light and the glory passed away, the Roman guard ventured to raise their heads and look about them. They were filled with amazement as they saw the great stone had been rolled from the door and of the grave and that the body of Jesus was gone. They hastened to the city to make known to the priests and the elders what they'd seen. The Roman guards were now on their way back, telling what happened. As those murderers listened to the marvelous reports, paleness set upon every face. Horror seized them at the thought of what they had done. If the report was correct, they were lost. For a time, they sat in silence, looking upon one another's faces, not knowing what to do or what to say. To accept the report would be to condemn themselves. They went aside to consult as to what should be done. They reasoned that if the report brought by the guard should be circulated among the people, those who put Christ to death would be slain as his murderers. It was decided to hire the soldiers to keep the matter secret. They were going to pay the soldiers off. That was their only option. They were the witnesses. They got to buy the witnesses off. The priests and the elders offered them a large sum of money, saying, "Say you, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept." So they're going to blame the disciples. This is what they're going to tell the people. And when the guards inquired what would be done with them for sleeping at their post, the Jewish officers promised to persuade the governor and secure their safety. For the sake of money, the Roman soldiers sold their honor. So that was the plan. They had to explain it somehow. So they were going to buy the Roman soldiers off, pay them a lot of money, keep their mouths shut, change the story. And this is the story we're going to go with. This is the story we're going to run with and tell the people. So, I have no proof that what I just read you is true. I have no proof in the cross, physical proof like that could be presented in a courtroom. Absolute. It takes a certain amount of faith. However, I think there is some very strong evidence, I would say proof. Now, I don't have a problem believing it, but and I know that you don't either. But there are people who do. This weekend, the Christian world is celebrating Easter. And our consideration turns to, can we really be sure that the events surrounding the story of the cross actually happened as we believe they did? So this is what I want to talk to you today, how I'm convinced. I don't have to have the information that I have here today to believe it, But I think if you had it and knew about it, it might help someone whose faith is weak. Someone wrote a letter to Billy Graham Ministries, and it says, "How can you believe that Jesus actually rose from the dead and came back to life? I hope this doesn't offend you, but this is such a fantastic claim that I just can't imagine how anybody could believe it." So there's people out there that don't believe it. The resurrection is the epicenter of belief for the Christian church. Without the resurrection, there's no Christian church. Author C.H. Dodd says, "It's not a belief that grew up within the church, like some of our beliefs that we have. It's a belief around which the church itself grew up with, upon which its faith was based." In other words, the resurrection, the belief that Christ is alive today, simply isn't one of our 28 fundamental beliefs, as we Adventists put it. No, what happened that night, or Easter Sunday, however you prefer to refer to it, that is the church. That is the Christian church. It's the foundation for everything. Everything rises and falls on this pass-fail moment. There are many religious misinterpretations that we could survive. People are always predicting such and such a thing, and in error, it doesn't come true. But their faith remains strong. They still believe in the Messiah. They keep studying and growing. Our own Adventist denomination, before its official beginnings, made some big errors in what they believed, expecting and preaching that Jesus would return in 1843. And then again in 1844. Those who taught and believed that, they were wrong. But the majority of them remained Christians and hung in there. It was an error, but it wasn't a fatal error. But you can't say that about the doctrine of the resurrection. If it turns out we're wrong about that, Paul tells us our journey of faith ends at that horrible moment of discovery. The Christian faith ceases to exist. Redemption crumbles and dies right there. Our preaching is useless, and so is your faith, Paul writes. Now, I want to bring out 3 points today. Why you can believe in the resurrection. There are 3 practical points. I mean, let's face it, none of us were there. We have the Bible, which we certainly hang our faith on, but there's no eyewitnesses. We weren't there. There were eyewitnesses, but not alive. But I think there are some evidence that we can actually hang our faith on, our belief, help solidify that what actually happened was true. Now, you've seen pictures of the empty tomb over there in Jerusalem, and I'm sure many of you too. We've seen pictures that has a sign hanging over it and says, "He is not here, he is risen." That's from Luke chapter 24. People go to the tomb, vacationers, pilgrims go, and the tomb was just redone recently. There's about a 3 or 4 year project where they completely redid and went, excavated down to the very level, where they believe that Jesus actually laid. Now, that's not the part the public sees because it's been covered up by, you know, years of people living. And it's just, but anyway, the sign's there, says he's not here, he's risen. And 2,000 years later, no one's ever come up with a reasonable alternative to explain away this empty tomb. Was Jesus unconscious at the cross and later revived? No, because the Roman centurions and Pilate made 100% sure that Jesus was dead. The Roman soldiers were there, witnesses saw the spear go in the side of Jesus. The forces of hell itself were present at Calvary to make sure that Jesus was dead. These people wanted him dead, and they made sure he was dead. If anyone in authority had taken away his body, it would have been easy to stop this new movement by simply producing Jesus' body. And that would have been the end of the Christian church. When the Pharisees were told that Jesus was gone, we would have loved to have been able to produce his body. That would have stopped everything right dead in its tracks. But they couldn't. They couldn't produce a body. They would have given their right arm more than that to produce Jesus' body. Now in Matthew chapter 27, it tells us about a wealthy Jew named Joseph of Arimathea. And he'd gotten permission from Pontius Pilate to bury Jesus in his own private tomb, But the priests and Pharisees who had engineered the crucifixion, they also came to Pilate. And these enemies had two great objectives. First, they wanted Jesus dead. They had accomplished that. But secondly, it was imperative that they keep him dead, especially for those first 3 days. Jesus himself had said back in chapter 16 that he would be raised to life on the third day. Now the Pharisees might have feared that the disciples would try to fake something, steal the body, and then claim he was resurrected. Or remembering the recent Lazarus miracle, their greater fear was that he would indeed emerge from the tomb alive. And they were well aware just recently that Lazarus had been resurrected by Jesus. So they asked Pilate for a Roman guard to be posted. The Pharisees had gone to Pilate. They want this Roman guard posted. Pilate was about over this thing. He was disgusted with his whole business. He wanted to set Jesus free. They wouldn't have it. If Pilate would have set Jesus free, then his rulership over the area would have been over, because they would have complained to the Roman hierarchy that they were allowing this man, this Jew, Jesus, this subversive, to keep on and undermine the Roman authority, and the Roman authorities would not have been happy with Pilate, so his career would have been over. He really didn't want to have Jesus executed, but he knew that his job hung on that. If the people were that bent on doing it, he pretty much had to go along with it. So he was already disgusted with this, angry for giving in to these people, letting them have their way, but if he didn't, he was going to be in trouble. Now the answer is recorded in Matthew 27, verse 65. Pilate said, "Take a guard, go make the tomb as secure as you know how." He's giving him permission. "I'll give you the guards. You do it however you want to do it. Make yourself happy so that you're satisfied. If you want the tomb guarded, go get it guarded." Now, while it was still dark, there was an earthquake. A heavenly angel came down and, almost like flicking a breadcrumb off the table, rolled that huge, unmovable stone out of the way. Jesus went from death to life with the greatest of ease, and he walked out of the tomb and began the Christian church. Now, again, just for a moment, focus on what Pontius Pilate and the Roman guards, the Pharisees and the priests, they had to work with. In verse 66, it's rendered in the expanded paraphrase. "So the priest went to the gravesite to make sure the entrance of the tomb was closed. They poured some hot wax where the edge of the stone touched the tomb to seal it with the Roman seal so that no one would dare roll it away." I mean, with that Roman seal, that wax seal on there, even if you did try to do it, they would kill you. They told the guards to stay alert because they could expect grave robbers to come during the night and steal the body. So that's what they told the Roman guards. Be ready for grave robbers. Now that was the reality of the situation. That was a political thing that was going on at that time. Here's another description from E.G. White. "A great stone had been placed before the opening. Across the stone they placed cords, securing them to the solid rock and sealing them with the Roman seal. The stone could not be moved without breaking the seal. A guard of 100 soldiers was then stationed around the tomb to prevent it from being tampered with. Now, can you imagine a grave, any grave that you've ever been to, stationing 100 men around it? You know, I've been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers in Washington. Have any of you been there? It's really impressive. And those guys are there. They're not fooling around. And there's not that many of them. I didn't remember counting them, but I mean, there's like a couple. And then they come in and change the guard. During that changing, there's a few more. But, you know, people are all gathered around there, and it's a real reverent place. And the day we were there, somebody was getting a little loud, and the guard said, "Quiet," just like that. And you could have heard a feather drop. I mean, I would say that place was secure with those Marines standing there, too. Now, this has got 100 men standing around this grave. I would say it's secure. Nobody's going to get in there. The single greatest source of opposition to the resurrection comes from those who suggest that the disciples themselves stole the body. And as we read at the beginning, that was the whole plan to begin with, was to say that the disciples stole the body. That's what the Pharisees came up with. And of course, even today, people still carry on with that. But it seems pretty improbable, doesn't it, with in light of all these soldiers and everything? Now, this is how the theory goes. The disciples stole the body, hid it, dried their tears, and began to preach about a fictional resurrection, and that they kept that up that facade right down to the time they died. Now, common sense tells us that's not likely, is it? When you think about it, could you do something like that? Your whole life of hardship over a lie that you concocted? See, this is where I'm saying that we can believe this, even with just some common sense. Now, let me expand on this theory. Born-again Christian Watergate prisoner Chuck Colston, Watergate was when Nixon was president, for those of you who weren't alive then. And they broke into the Democratic headquarters and in a motel complex called Watergate, and they supposedly stole Democrat Party secrets. That's what Watergate was about. And Nixon knew about it and gave his blessings. That's the way the thing goes. Anyway, Colston worked for Nixon, and he got in trouble over this. And he actually spent time in prison for this break-in. And he provides one of the most compelling refutations to this part of the conspiracy. And it comes from his own experience in reference to the Watergate burglaries. As a lie, and they did try to cover it up, as a lie was being concocted for the purpose of saving the Nixon presidency, he and his co-conspirators quickly found that when people are threatened, not even with death and lions and persecution, but just a cream puff country club minimal prison sentence, lies don't hold up. The Watergate covered up lasted less than 2 weeks. All the main players began to plea bargain and sing their confessions to the special prosecutor. In other words, if you tell us this, we're going to get you a lighter sentence. Say they were all ratting each other out. As Chuck Colson and many other Christians today consider the incredible persecutions endured by the early church, it's clear that hiding the body conspiracy would never hold up. It wouldn't have lasted. Paul Little, in his book titled Know What You Believe, writes, "Men will die for what they believe to be true, though it actually may be false. However, they do not die willingly for what they know to be a lie." Author Dr. John Stotts says it a little bit differently in observing, "People are not willing to become martyrs for a lie which they themselves have perpetrated." Doesn't that make common sense? Nobody would do that. That's just insane. It's just not going to happen. You can't be that crazy. All right. Second thing I'd like to talk to you about, it's mentioned by Paul himself. There were so many eyewitnesses. So many people saw with their own eyes that Jesus was alive. In 1 Corinthians 15:5, Paul lists them. He appeared to Peter, then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living. If they would have refuted it then, if that wasn't the case, but it was true. Then he appeared to James, then to all the disciples, and at last of all, he appeared to me also. And the third and final point here, how can we be confident that the resurrection is a true story? Well, one way is simply by the emergence of the Christian church after the crucifixion. The existence of this unique movement, this global family around the world, that in itself is dynamic and compelling body of evidence. I'll quote again from Dr. Stott's book, The Relevance of the Resurrection. Something happened to change the apostles and to send them out on their mission to the world. When Jesus died, they were heartbroken, confused, and frightened. But within less than 2 months, they came out of hiding full of joy, confidence, and courage. What can account for this dramatic transformation? From that bunch of disillusioned nobodies has grown a universal community numbering one-third of the population of the world. It would take a lot of something, gullibility, denial, stupidity, I don't know, to believe the whole Christian belief is built on a lie. In his book by Philip Yancey titled The Jesus I Never Knew, he says, Resurrection, a Morning Beyond Belief, where he makes a point. The book's titled Resurrection, a Morning Beyond Belief. He says that Jesus succeeded in changing a sniffling band of unreliable followers into fearless evangelists. That 11 men who had deserted him at death now went on to martyrs' graves, avowing their faith in a resurrected Christ. That these few witnesses managed to set loose a force that would overcome violent opposition, and it was violent. First in Jerusalem, then in Rome, this remarkable sequence of a transformation offers the most convincing evidence for the resurrection. What else explains the whiplash change in men known for their cowardice and instability? From the book Desire of Ages, speaking of the stakes involved at Calvary, Ellen White's description is, the darkest hour just before daybreak had come, Christ was still a prisoner in his narrow tomb. The great stone was in place, the Roman seal was unbroken, the Roman guards were keeping their watch, and there were unseen watchers. A host of evil angels were gathered about the place. Had it been possible, the Prince of Darkness with his apostate army would have kept forever sealed the tomb that held the Son of God. And that's incredible because Jesus had created Satan. Satan's hosts were there, waiting, watching, hoping, muttering their desperate curses. Keeping Jesus dead was the number one item on their agenda. In fact, their destiny depended on it. And here's the rest of the story. This is again from Desire of Ages. When Jesus was laid in the tomb, Satan triumphed. He dared to hope the Savior would not take up his life again. He claimed the Lord's body. Now, isn't that interesting? He can claim you and me because we're all sinners. But Jesus didn't sin, but he still tried. And he set his guard about the tomb, seeking to hold Christ a prisoner and keep him dead. And now this, he was bitterly angry when his angels fled at the approach of the heavenly visitor. When he saw Christ come forth in triumph, he knew that his kingdom would have an end and he must finally die. That indeed was a night to remember, wouldn't you say? Amen. And